Hey guys, it's Maggie Lawson.
And I'm Timothy Amundsen.
In this episode, we are thrilled to have the one, the only, Sean Spencer, a.k.a. James Rodé Rodriguez, a.k.a. Joms, as I call him. We will talk about how James got to where he is today. We are going to focus on season one, episode two, The Spelling Bee, but we get into so much more, and we can't wait. So let's go. Hello, everyone. Just a heads up, if you're wondering why the audio sounds a little different on this one, it's because we're calling this one the episode where everything goes wrong audio-wise. But mostly, it's because I did not hit record on the better-sounding audio device, which is a very Maggie thing to do. I think James even has some sirens at one point, and Tim... Well, actually, Tim is perfect. Tim is perfect, but we already knew that. So please enjoy this episode of The Psychologists Are In. This is episode two with James Rodé Rodriguez. We talk about a lot of things and episode two of season one, Spelling Bee. Hi, Tim. Hi, Joms. So this is episode two of The Psychologists Are In, and we are here with our Psych Rewatch episode to relive all of our fun memories, tell stories, and all that good stuff, and our very, very special, dear to both of our hearts, star of the show, the person who took care of all of us, who made this all such a family, so special, and the uber, obviously talented James Rodé Rodriguez.
Thank you. The pleasure is obviously all Tim's.
not yet. Wait, I got some great James. Ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
This is just for you, Jamie.
Oh my God, yes. We're getting Sternbush.
You remember when we first started, it was all like dark and stuff. It's like all my hair and beard.
I wish I could just wander out of frame and then get lost in it, you know?
You know where I live, buddy. Mm-hmm.
I love the gray, Tim. I really do. It's good.
We're friends, Maggie.
Yeah, and he didn't even pay me to say that this time.
It's hot, dude.
It's hot.
There's a dinner on it for both of you.
So, Joms, as I call you, I just wanted to kind of start at the beginning for everybody, for us, and how Psych came to you, when you got the script, where you were in your life, what it felt like, all the good stuff. So, start at the beginning. You got Psych the script.
Sure. Yeah, I was actually I was working dim streets when I got.
What does that mean? What were dim streets?
Yeah, well, I was using my instrument to earn a living, and it was going reasonably well. But I didn't see a lot of a future in it. So it's not something that I was, you know, hooked into for the long term. The truth is, if I remember correctly, and keep in mind that I'm an aged man, so. I'm sure that some of this is conflated, and there's really no way to check my facts because only I know them. So, but I will retell this as best as I recall it. And as I recall it, I had been in Los Angeles for going on 7 years, I think, and I had done like three network television series, none of which had lasted longer than a year. So I was working, and because of that, I felt lucky, and I felt appreciative in that, you know, I was still connected to a lot of people that I knew from college in New York who hadn't been given those opportunities and were just as talented, if not more talented than I was. So I was conflicted in that, like, I was a working actor in Los Angeles, but I wasn't doing anything that I thought was particularly compelling. I didn't think that I was contributing much to the shows that I was on. No one was watching them anyway. And I felt like I was having, like, I was staring down the barrel of 30. So, like, I was 29 years old. And I had what I think was, like, sort of my first existential artist crisis, for lack of an even more pretentious term that I could probably come up with if I thought about it. I just felt I was not satisfied, and I felt like I was kind of floundering, and that, you know, this isn't why I'd become an actor. So I had recently made the decision to change it up. I was never particularly fond, as you know, of living in Los Angeles anyway. I hadn't really found my groove. I hadn't really found my niche or where I sort of fit into that culture. So I decided, you know, screw it. I did this thing. I gave it a shot. I'm going back to New York. And that felt comfortable to me. It felt like something I could lean into. It came with a whole different set of anxiety, because I don't know if it's still like this, but back then, and this was, you know, a while ago, if you left New York before you kind of established yourself as a theater actor, which is exactly what I did, and then you came back with like LA television stink on you, that was generally not helpful. Like that worked against you. And so I was going back to New York knowing that that was something that I was a challenge that I was going to have to overcome. But I told my agent at the time, like, you're not going to talk me out of this. This is a decision I've made. I'm going to New York. I'm going to find an apartment to rent, and we'll just, you know, we'll play it by ear, but start getting me theater auditions, because I think that's where I belong, and I need to go back to that. So that was the plan, and the plan was in motion. And my then agent, a very good agent named Stephen Hirsch, who to this day I remain very fond of, and was instrumental in the, you know, in the beginnings of my career, got the script for Psych, sort of apprehensively called and said, listen, I know we just broke down the whole thing, and I know what you want to do, and I know what the plan is, and I'm not telling you that shouldn't be the plan. I'm just telling you, it would be remiss of me as your agent to not say, I think you should read this. I think you need to read this. And that's all I'm going to say. And he was talking about the script for Psych. And because he presented it to me in such a non-aggressive sort of like, just read it and then you can toss it sort of way, I didn't get offended. We didn't have like a quibble of like, look, man, I just told you I didn't want to do any more TV. Like, he kind of nailed he really stuck the landing, so that I felt like, oh, it's okay. I will read the first 10 to 15 pages of this pilot dutifully, because my agent wants me to, and then I will set it down and plan move back to New York. We'll go into full effect. So the timing of it was pretty wild, because then of course I read the first 10, and then I had to keep reading, and then it was 20, and then it was 30, and then I had read the whole pilot. And my initial response was, this reminds me a lot of a movie that was very near and dear to my heart called Real Genius, with a character that Val Kilmer played named Chris Knight. And I thought, wow, this sort of overgrown Peter Pan man boy reminds me so much of that character. And that character was so like pivotal in my sort of development for why I wanted to become an actor. So like, I don't know if it could have hit like closer to the center of the target for me, of something that would really, really resonate and kind of catch me off guard, because of the similarities to that movie and that character. I felt weird. I felt conflicted, and I felt like I'd made a decision on the one hand and I needed to stick to it. And for all the reasons that I thought it was going to be a good decision and that it was going to be the change that I needed on one side, and on the other side, I was like, well, shit, this kind of feels like a hand in glove, like, you know, role that was like almost made for me in a way. And then Stephen was like, and then again, playing it very, you know, he was like, just, you know, just meet the guy who wrote it. Again, there's no stakes here. Like, you're not making any kind of commitment. You just keep looking at apartments in New York and just take a meeting. He continued to sort of keep me from feeling like I was doing anything that would compromise, you know, this line in the sand that I had drawn, so that I kept, you know, I was able to feel comfortable as I kept taking the steps that led to ultimately abandoning said plan and doing another television pilot. But the second step was meeting with Steve. As you both know, meeting with Steve is, it's like getting a tour of of Willy Wonka's chocolate factory.
It's so true.
He's just a giant, delightful, human-sized bottle of like Sunny Delight, like the original formula.
not Sunny D.
Yeah. The Sunny
Delight
we grew up with. Yeah. It's just his outlook on life is so it's so purely positive. And I hadn't been around a lot of people like that in my life. So the script was great. I thought it had a ton of potential. And then I meet this man who's so high on life and just wants to have a good time. And you know, he tells me I was thinking of Ferris Bueller. I tell him I read it as Chris Knight. And we both are so steeped in the 80s and movies of the 80s that, of course, the idea that you could somehow thread that needle and like combine Ferris Bueller with Chris Knight then became like the most exciting thing either of us had ever heard. He was so collaborative in that first meeting. Like everything I said, like you could just see him getting more excited about where this could go.
And that was probably important. Like that was a big deal for you. I mean, you're
100% because I had yet to experience that kind of freedom or that level of collaboration on anything that I had worked on. It was just a gun for hire. And he basically said, look, I'm going to treat you like a partner on this. I want to sort of customize this experience for your process. I told him that, you know, I felt like I was at my best when I had a long leash and I, you know, and I had the freedom to improvise. He said he would never be precious about his words, which at the time sounded cool. But after doing this for 20 years and working with predominantly writers who are precious about their words, it's a special thing to find someone who says that and means it in such a like a wholly truthful, like loving, collaborative way, the way that Steve does. Like he really will treat a script that he's put his heart and soul into as a blueprint. And the second it starts to veer off course in a fun and inventive way, he'll just jump on the ride, you know? Mm. And I think that was an absolutely necessary ingredient for me to reach the next step, which was, okay, I'm going to crack this open creatively. I'm going to start working on this material and I'm going to see if I can convince everybody that I'm the guy for this. I felt like Steve and I kind of had to be, you know, bound ride or die. And, you know, he told me very early on, like, you are it, you're my guy, let's do this. And I believed him. So the process then kind of became us as opposed to like just me. And that felt good. That felt cool. And still, like in my mind, I'm like, all right, this is a detour, right? This is a quick, even if this happens, I'm going to go shoot this pilot for this fledgling network that I really only knew because wrestling was on it. I had never even watched Monk. I mean, I knew Tony Shalhoub was on it and that he's really good and that like people our parents' age really love that show. But I had never seen it. So I had no context for the USA Network at all. So in my mind, I'm like, I'm going to go do this little thing that might be the most fun I've ever had, but chances are that's where it ends. And then I will still, you know, land in New York and I'll be doing a play, you know, by the fall, hopefully, you know, beginning of the next year at the latest. And that is what took us into the actual process, which was relatively easy. I mean, I was clearly set up to win this role. The testing process, you know, for anyone who's watching who doesn't know what that means, it's changed a lot over the years. But back then, it was two pronged, right? Because you have a studio who's behind a show that writes the checks, and then you have a network that's behind a show that allows the platform for which, you know, the show can air on, and these two sort of entities have to coexist and sort of get along. But you generally had to test twice. You had to test for the studio first, and they would have to be like, okay, we advance you on, and then you would test for the network. And that had always sort of been the process. And then there are like casualties, right? Some people don't make it past the studio. Some people don't make it past the studio by design. It's a really ugly sort of neo-political awful process that I would wish upon no one. But for this one, I remember they combined it, right? They mushed everybody from both entities into one conference room with a really long conference table so that I would only have to like dance once. And I thought, oh, this is really cool. Like, you're chopping half of the process away. I appreciate that.
Wait, so all of USA was in there?
It was, Universal and USA. Universal. And they were all jammed in one room. I think they asked my permission early on to put my test on one of the DVDs. So it's out there, like it's on the internet somewhere. And there were a couple other guys, God bless them. But I can tell you, like, it would have been a huge upset if somehow, I hadn't won the day, because that was really what it was sort of designed to be. And because of that, I felt almost no nerves. And again, I think I was tremendously aided by the fact that I had a plan.
Yeah.
And this wasn't it. So like, I didn't give a shit if it worked out or not. I really love Steve, and I thought, oh, this could be fun, but I was good either way. So I went in there so loose and so like footloose and fancy free. I remember I did some silly like improv that lasted 40 seconds before I even started the first line, because I was just like swinging it. I was just swinging it. Feeling good. And there were all these people, and it was a ridiculous setup because it wasn't the right space for this. It was just a long conference table. I was like, I'm going to play the length of the table. Like, I didn't give a shit. And I went in there and I just sort of dropped the mic, and it all went according to plan. And, Steve was happy, and Chris Henze, our other executive producer, and Kelly Kolchak, our third executive producer. Like, it was all a big love fest. I did it. It was great. The studio and the network. Yeah, we did it. You found this guy. What a great thing. And Maggie, you can attest to this more than anybody. Like, there's always like a weird curveball that you don't see coming. Like, anytime it feels too good to be true, anytime this process goes too smoothly, there's a reason for that. And so after all of that, and the high fives and the love and everything, we get a call saying, okay, he is the network's choice. He's the studio's choice. He's obviously Steve's choice. We all adore him. We love him. There's just this one tiny little element of we offered the part to Matthew Perry. But as soon as he passes, because we don't think he's going to do it, it's all systems go with James, and we couldn't be more excited. So I never ever knew that. Yeah. So there was like a 72-hour period wherein Steve was just, checking in with me every day, saying he's not going to do it, he's not going to do it, he's not going to. And I was like, okay, I appreciate this, I love you for it, but I have to tell you, you should kind of want Matthew Perry to do your show. Because if he says yes, it's going to get picked up, and it's going to be a series on the air, and people are going to tune in. Because I think at that point, it would have been like his follow-up to Friends, I think.
Yeah.
I don't think there had been anything between those two things. Like, he'd done some movies, but this would have been like Chandler's return to TV. And of course, like, he's older than me, and it would have been a very sort of, they would have had to rearrange some stuff and rewrite some stuff. And if the Sean Henry thing would have been the same as it was, so obviously it would have been a different show. But for a couple of days there, everything was hanging in the balance. Again, I couldn't have cared less, because I was just like, whatever, the universe has got this one. My eyes are set on New York City. And then he passed, presumably because there was no world wherein the USA network or the Universal cable could come close to affording what it would have cost to hire Matthew Perry to be on the show. And also he was probably like, USA, didn't they have silk stockings? No, I'm not doing that. so that went away. And then the rest was as smooth and easy as it was designed to be. You know, I was very lucky in that I was cast first, and they sort of cast the rest of the show around my silly energy. And I was a participant in the casting of every other role. Work sessions, studio tests, network tests, retests, like you name it. I was there for all of it and was able to have some input. You know, they always wanted to know what I thought. It was a dream.
Wow.
Like it, from the very beginning, it was just, and so much of that is Steve Franks and him wanting me to feel like, you know, we were two sides of the same coin. That was the lead up. To actually, you know, making the thing. And again, I felt like I was in a great headspace because this just felt like a fun extra thing that came out of nowhere. And there were no stakes attached to it for me, other than have a great time, leave it all on the field. And here's an opportunity for you to actually be seen. Not literally, but as an artist, here's a chance for you to stretch and show a more accurate sort of representation of what you can do than you have ever been able to before.
Not that your work on the street wasn't artistry.
It was a different kind of artistry. Look, I've never had the most fluid of hips. I'm never going to be accused of being like a Limberman. So yeah, it was, my days were numbered, but thank you for saying that, Tim.
But now we know why you were so limber and loose on the pilot. No, so you obviously had been doing a different kind of research prior to the role. So by the time you got to set, you were ready to go, baby.
And that was just dumb luck. And also, like, if I'd been, I don't know, even 1 year older, like if we had started when I was 31, I don't think I would have been able to perform some of those physical tasks. But yeah, so then it was about casting the rest of you assholes. And Mags was not a part of that process initially.
No.
So, you know, Dule came next. And he should tell you that story because he lived it. But there was a wrinkle for him too. And
what was his wrinkle? Oh, well, I guess we'll let Dule tell.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'll tee it up. Like it was all set up for him to come in and win the day. Charlie from West Wing, Emmy nominated Dule Hill, not what Steve had written for the role of Gus, but an exciting option that nobody had really considered or thought of. And again, to Steve's credit, the second that it was pitched and became a possibility, he just jumped right on it. I think in his mind, he had always been thinking like Ferris, Bueller, and Cameron. It's Ferris and Cameron. Mm. And then here comes Dule, not Cameron, in any way, shape, or form. But he saw the possibilities. He saw something beyond what he had created. And instead of like holding on to this thing, like this baby and saying, no, 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 he immediately was like, yes, absolutely. So again, the table was set, boom, boom, boom. And then, Dule had to test twice. So I'll let him tell the rest of that story. But it was good for some juice and some drama.
Wow.
If I recall, Corbin came next. That was a real crapshoot. I can't remember if he was like the favorite or not, but once I read with everybody, he was clearly like the guy we needed. Which was fun for me because, you know, he was Corbin Burnson from Major League. So I was getting my first dose of like 80s fanboy, which would become, you know, a big part of the show for me right out of the gates by reading with Corbin. And then in came handsome, lanky, ex-medicine ball judging Amy, Tim Amundsen. And I remember clear as day that you were the guy that they wanted. I do think that they threw some other sweet poor bastard in there. As Yeah, you would have had to come in and poop yourself and then show everybody that you'd pooped yourself, I think, to blow that one.
Well, Tim kind of tells that story, but he kind of did for a second.
Luckily, Adrian's man had his car battery died, so he couldn't make it to the test. And then there was a fellow that was in the waiting room who was a big movie star at the time had been in a tremendously huge film, who then later did our show. We were lucky enough
to have him join us. It was Tommy Howell, that's right.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Right.
And we were like sitting in the room going, great, oh, there's freaking, see, Tommy Howell. This isn't going to work. I don't have a shot in hell.
He's awesome, and we are obviously big fans of his. But I think looking where we were and looking all the way down the field as to, you know, this is a show that could potentially go, which is how you have to think, you know, he was not Lasseter. And I think that became clear pretty quickly. And Tim absolutely was Lasseter.
Yeah, there's a moment in my particular test, which I've told the story on other episodes, which I'll tell now, where I wanted to beat the living shit out of you so badly in my test because I was so prepped up and prepared, and then you went off book and so totally threw me. And I walked out of the room, and then like I did the scene once, walked out of the room just like furious and like spitting fire on the way out. And Steve comes out and is like, okay, let me give you a note. The note is we're not sure that you're a strong enough force against this guy. So can you come in and maybe be a little stronger? And I was like, watch this. So you ended up giving me this amazing gift because I went in with such wind in my sails and full of piss and vinegar that I just wanted. So it was, yeah, last year was really ready to destroy Sean Spencer. I think I was talking to one of the other actors outside. I was like, motherfucker went off book. And I think they were committed too. And I was like, we're like, yeah, well, that's not going to happen on the series.
I'm sure Dulé will echo that when you talk to him as well. I think, especially coming from Aaron Sorkin show, he was not prepared for my ways either. But, you know, just me as an actor, I was like, oh, man, that's a terrible thing to do to another actor who doesn't have the job yet. But, you know, Steve kept encouraging me. He was like, I want to see if these actors can play off of you. I want to see if they have improvisational skills. So keep doing it. Like, keep doing it. I kept being encouraged to, like, you know, fuck around and do my thing. So I went with it. And
then flash forward to the series where you actually taught me so much about improvising and quick comedy. You really did. So I credit you for that. So
I don't know. Yeah. I hadn't worked with anybody that I got to play like that with. And I think you did in our test as well. These stories are so fun for me to hear because I came on later. So I don't know this like initial process that everybody kind of went through. So it's really fun.
Moving on to you, I can tell you that the casting of the original character, whose name was what?
Lucinda.
Yeah.
Lucinda. I should know this because she
Lucinda.
Was
Lucinda.
Yeah. That was the thing we couldn't crack. Like the show was cast and we tested that role once, could not get consensus. Tested it again with a whole new batch of potential actresses, couldn't get a consensus. Tested it a third time, again, with a new set of people. And we went like we could not have cast a wider net. It was every type, you know, you can imagine. We brought in so many different versions. And honestly, there was never a full across the boards, like sign off of, okay, we've got our Lucinda. But there was one actress who tested all three times. Like there was one actress who kept hanging in, even though she wasn't getting it, she would test again against a new group. I didn't quite get it, test again. And that was Annie Dudek. So Annie, because they liked her enough to keep bringing her back and she tested multiple times.
It's a great actress, yeah.
And is really good at acting, ended up getting the role. You know, pretty close to when we needed to like go and start, but there was never like the resounding, like, oh my gosh, we've got are Lucinda the way that there was with all of these other characters. So I say that to sort of set up the fact that if there were going to be a character in the cycle that ended up, you know, not testing as well or not fitting in as well as the others, it's not a surprise that it ended up being Lucinda, because we had a really hard time casting her to begin with.
We should also, Lucinda was not, in the pilot script, there wasn't a whole lot for Lucinda to do. I think it was mostly kind of like banter between her and Lassiter.
Yeah, I mean,
so it wasn't a terribly flashy role where we go, oh, the actress is going to really glom onto that big.
And the characters were having an affair, right?
She was an affair with Lassiter.
Lassiter right. was separated. They were dating. Yes, they were dating.
Sorry, not an affair. Not an affair, guys.
Okay, well. But they were doing it. They were doing the nighttime dance, and right. And I think she was supposed to be slightly bemused and curious about Sean in a way that would antagonize Lassiter even further.
Right. Because
he was so firmly antagonistic, and I think that was sort of what they had in mind for the two of them, is that over time, you know, maybe she would start to believe and he wouldn't, and how would that affect their relationship? And I think that's kind of what they had on the board for those two. And then, you know, we make a pilot, everybody really digs it, sees a lot of potential, they test it, and that thing that they had sort of decided would be the Lassiter Lucinda thing was the thing that people were kind of the most on the fence about. And when that happens and you get, you know, the same feedback enough times, it starts a conversation, and you only have one chance to make a move like that before. And it's between pilot and series, right? Like, if you're going to pull the trigger, that's when you have to do it. That was the thing that I think people were sort of the least interested in, or like, I don't know, they just didn't respond to that element of the pilot the way that they responded to everything else. And so the conversation started, and again, to Steve's credit, like, this is a guy who's never had a TV show before, right? He has no experience to draw from. He's just winging it the whole time. And he's like, yeah, I think this is an opportunity. And we were all like, in total agreement that Annie Dudek was a great actress. Like, there's no question that we had somebody who was talented. But the fit felt like maybe it could be a little bit better. And I think Annie, you know, to her credit, acknowledged that as well. And so we saw the opportunity to maybe go in a different direction with that role, mine a little bit more comedy out of it. A brighter overall energy, a lighter energy, and thus began the search for a new lady detective, which landed us Maggie Mawson.
Well,
I think if I recall, the breakdown was Ray of Sunshine.
Ray of Sunshine.
Joms, I want to ask just on the pilot, did you know when you were shooting it, both of you actually, did you guys have that feeling of like, I think this is going to be something, or was it still kind of in that space of like, this is kind of risky, I don't know, like how did that feel?
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Is there something interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals? I mean, I think we can all relate to that on some level. I know I can. BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. You can start communicating in under 48 hours. It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It is professional therapy done securely online. There is a broad range of expertise available, which may not be locally available in many areas. The service is available for clients worldwide. You can log into your account anytime and send a message to your therapist. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions, so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room, as with traditional therapy. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change therapist if needed. It's more affordable than traditional offline therapy, and financial aid is available. BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. Visit BetterHelp.com/pineapple. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P, and join the over 2 million people who have taken charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. Special offer for the Psychologists Are In listeners. Get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/pineapple. That's 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/pineapple.
Yeah, I don't think I had the, oh my God, this is lightning in a bottle feeling yet. I think we were in Vancouver, which felt kind of odd.
Yeah.
And again, I think psych, and you could probably stretch this throughout the first 16 episodes. I would say the whole first season of psych was about potential, right? But the mechanism itself was still sort of finding its way. And you know, that pilot is kind of all over the place. You go back and watch it, like it's a bunch of people sort of just slinging stuff around and seeing what landed and what didn't land, me especially. I think if you just isolate the pilot away from the series and everything that it became, you know, us having lived it and the evolution and knowing where we ended up taking it, and just looked at the pilot, I don't know that you would go, oh my gosh, like it was the planets aligning. It was just one of those jobs where you just knew the second you walked on set that, you know, you would hit pay dirt. I don't know that the pilot was that. I think the opportunity to keep doing it, adding you, Maggie, finding the comedy in a way that we could consistently sort of, you know, oh, we can do this, and then getting confident enough to start taking bigger swings and grow ourselves and find more of a culty audience. Like all of those things conspired to make it the job of a lifetime. But on the pilot, I think it was like, these people are cool. I love Steve Franks. I love that he's letting me goof off and goof around. I don't know if anybody's going to think this is good. Like, I still don't know what USA is. I just don't know. I think is sort of where I was at. Where were you at, Tim?
I had actually never done a pilot before. This was the first. I hadn't tested for a pilot in like 8 years when I walked in that room to try and get this job. So I didn't know what the hell I was doing or what I was supposed to expect. I just knew that, like, yeah, I was having fun and really liked the people I was working with. So I do remember, James, a moment of where I broke your heart a little bit. We were sitting, I think, in a certain restaurant bar across the street from our hotel, having some libations, and there was a sports ball game on. And you asked me if I was a sports fan because we were trying to bond it. And I was like, not really. You just, I saw the crush in your face. Just kind of like, oh. But that might have been the first episode after the pilot.
Yeah, that's my. But you at least acknowledged that you knew who the Seahawks were.
Considering you were from Seattle.
I do make you very proud one moment on the show, actually. I'd really gotten into the Seahawks and started. I actually figured out how to watch a Seahawks game on my computer. And I was sitting on set watching a game. And you came over and looked at you. It's like you're such a proud papa.
Oh, I love that. That's like taking Tim to a sports bar to bond. That's funny.
That's all I knew how to do.
I took him shopping. I know how to bond with Tim.
that was a better idea.
That's very true. We had our shopping trips, and James and I had our attempts at sports ball bars. Do you remember, we did go to that one. I didn't really enjoy, James, just for the record, when there would be a big game on, and you sort of make plans, we're all going to meet at that particular bar and watch a game. That was always really fun, and I sort of learned how to watch sports with you.
Yeah, but it was more about fraternity, fellowship, the drinks that they had there. The view of things that weren't on the television. There were a lot of other elements.
Coming in from the rain.
I feel like we all discovered very early that we do a lot of things as a group very well.
No, we just love being around each other, man. It didn't matter what we were doing. Like, really, really didn't. We were just lucky. We were all in places in our lives where it just made sense to want that family, that sense of community up there. And again, like, if you start listing off like all the things that had to be just so for this show to become what it did, you'd have to start with, okay, well, here was the group of people, but it wasn't just the group of people. It was, who were these people? Where were they in their lives? So that they could be open and that their hearts could be open to each other the way that, that all of ours were. Cause like, you know, life is like this. And, you know, if half of us had been in different places where this was just a job that we clocked in and out of, like, it wouldn't have been the same. Like we all kind of came with our hearts open and they were penetrable. And we, you know, we all got penetrated together.
We did.
And howdy.
And we've cut into that part of the podcast. So if we did get into Spelling Bee a little bit, well, that was my, I think my character's intro. It was actually the second episode we shot, which Tim and I had talked about Speak Now.
Yeah. So remind me. So like we meet you in Spelling Bee, but that's not the first thing you shot. The first thing you shot was an episode that aired after Spelling Bee, right?
Exactly. So Speak Now when in the church, it's funny how I remember it because my test was with you, James. So my test was like our chemistry. And it's funny because when that show kind of first started, I mean, the majority of my stuff was actually with Tim and us developing. Yeah. So it's funny because I remember that act the shit out of it comes from that. We said that to each other for so many years, came from Speak Now where he looked at me and said, Maggie, what are you going to do? And I was like, what? Because I was so like, it was my first day. I was so new.
You were 16 years old. You were emancipated, which is the only reason you could be on set without your parents.
Absolutely. I told him I felt like I was dressing up in like my dad's like oversized suits for years before I actually kind of felt like I stepped into like an adult detective. I felt like such a, almost like a little girl, like playing the character.
Straight your dad wore pastel pantsuits.
Yeah, exactly. But the character, it's funny because like we actually had an episode or two, Joms, where it was second to air, it was third.
In the lineup, right. That sounds right.
So we had all had some time together by the time we shot that diner scene.
Right, which was helpful because we went way off whatever I remember was written and kind of gave it its own little life.
Well, yes, we did. I mean, you did. And then I kind of followed because that voice right. To this day, because that was my audition scene. I remember you did not use that voice in the test. Oh, my God. My genuine reaction. Yes.
Yeah. And it became a thing that we were able to go back to the well on.
No, we did a million times. Watching Speak Now, and I didn't, you know, we obviously had people in common. Other than our audition scene, I don't think I'd even seen the pilot of Psych. So
didn't we have anyone in common? I don't remember that.
Yeah. I love when you're like, so many things had to happen. The first building in Vancouver, I think about...
Which, by the way, I should tell you before I forget, our current on-set writer-producer, a lovely man that we all adore, who's up here with us on A Million Little Things, lives in the Crandall.
Have you been back there?
I've been over there a couple of times since. And boy, does that bring back like weird bursts of like visceral like images and memories. And those apartments still have the exact same floor
layout.
Plan.
Same layout. That's so weird.
Two bedrooms, yeah. Bathrooms packed into the tiniest little cube imaginable.
That don't actually have doors. They're just these like slider dividers. That's so funny. Yeah. So Joms and I, we discovered by chance, I think after the first cast dinner we all had, when you were like, my place is over here. And I was like, oh, I'll walk with you. I'm over there too. And we walked to the same exact building.
Yep. One floor apart.
And then that was off and running. But
we all got penetrated together, Tim. Remember? So we filmed your intro to the show after you had done a whole episode playing Detective Juliet O'Hara. And to your point, I think that was a good thing.
Yeah.
Because you at least had like one episode under your belt.
And I think when I had watched Speak Now, and Tim and I had kind of touched on this, or we had talked about this as well, watching you for the first time, I was like, I read the script that said, you know, it said, I think all it said was Sean has a psychic episode.
Oh yeah. That was big in the early seasons.
Of the wrap up. Right. But when we went to shoot it, it was this choreographed number. And I don't know that you actually planned it. Like it felt like it was all happening like really naturally. Like you were finding it as you go. You'd have 4-page breakdowns of cases basically, and somehow would manage to use the room, and it all makes sense. Half the time Tim and I were like, what, do you know what's happening? I don't know what's happening, but you would break it down in a way that like made sense. And as the episodes went on, the elaborate dance that I feel like all of that was something you brought.
I think early on, I mean, it was good because I was in a place where I was embracing that challenge. I thought it was great. I thought like every breakdown was going to be like this puzzle that I had to crack. And that was exciting to me. And I would show up like a little bit early on that day and I would walk whatever set we were in and I would like take note of things. And then it kind of became this like this spontaneous, let's see what happens. Enterprise, because they weren't scripting stuff. I think what we learned relatively quickly is that that was not something that was going to be able to sustain itself, you know, for the course of a series. You know, you do it once or twice, that's fine. But when it was like 2, 3, 4, 5 times, that's when, you know, we all started going, huh. And I think the writers started going, maybe we should start, you know, at least meeting him halfway on these things.
You talk about the breakdown specifically or just his random psychic episodes?
I would say the breakdown specifically, just because they were so long, like Mag said. I mean, look, we were never A-plus mystery writers. but we certainly got better as the show went along. But in those very, very early episodes, we were barely laying down clues, right? Like it was pretty shoddy storytelling in terms of the whodunit. So we had to basically tell you everything that the case was at the end so that you would have some idea of what you had just watched. So,
which 9 times out of 10 is the only reason I understood the episode.
That's what I was saying.
Only watching your portrayal.
Break it down. Yeah.
It was basically like him. It was like Tim Curry in Clue, where he has to kind of reenact the entire night, like over and over and over again. So that was what we were doing in that first season early on, and it was fun. It was fun, but I think. Yeah, I think everybody on set kind of knew like, well, this isn't going to, it can't be like this for too much longer. And then it was just sort of like meeting of minds again, Steve being Steve, you know, we kind of just, those things often happened organically without anyone having to say, hey man, this isn't working for me. It was always sort of something that we kind of just felt collectively. And so there was never any kind of like hardcore, like, yo, dude, these breakdowns have to, you know, you have to help me out here. I think he was just watching cuts going, Jesus. and then
they just,
they just started getting better and easier. And then because they started getting better and easier, I started feeling like I could do less. And that was also important because I think for the longevity of the series, like Sean being some heightened Ace Ventura type character was also going to be too much. And if you go back and watch, you know, early season one, there's so many big, like physical choices being made that I think would have lost the novelty had it been mostly that. What we discovered is that we can lean way more on, you know, wordplay and talking fast and visual gags that were quick, so that if we did do something really, really big and broad, it felt like, you know, an outlier as opposed to a norm. And I think that was really important for the series too, is like learning like, oh, we can go smaller. We need to go smaller. For all of us, but for me especially, It works. It works for a movie. Yeah, I don't think it works for eight seasons of television.
I would get so tired just watching you, but you made it all work. And I think for us too, watching that, I mean, I don't know, Tim, I feel like, I know for me, that first episode, you know, first couple of episodes between like Speak Now and Spelling Bee and all of us sort of, I mean, I was so new, but like all of us were figuring out our relationships and our characters and like everything. I know I felt like I hit the jackpot from meeting Steve, as you said, who is just this big kid who is excited about everything, but having sort of like you set a tone. Steve and our writers mostly were in LA or in Manhattan Beach. And so they were up, they were in and out, but like you were kind of the one who was holding the fort down in Vancouver. And I know for all of us, like we were all looking to you, like you were already sort of setting this tone of taking care of and making sure everybody was covered, not just us, but like the crew. And it really did, I feel like, start there. I mean, we all still say this to this day, like that's where we sort of started to find that, like, this is something else. This is beyond, but it really did. You were the one to sort of set that tone.
Yeah. How insane that guy like Sean was the adult in the room.
Like truly the leader. And yeah.
Well, I think what hit me probably about halfway through the first season was, so nobody's going to come here like and police us. And if you remember, the studio did try for about 5 seconds. They sent a dude who was kind of supposed to just wrangle us and keep an eye on us, because otherwise it was truly like, you know, the animals running the zoo. And I think
was that Joe?
That was, yes. Joe. Yes, right. Joe.
And I think just
maybe 2 episodes, maybe 3 episodes. And then it was just like, yo, man, that's not how this is not how we're going to succeed. And so when he left and it was back to basically just us, I think that's when it really hit me, like, oh my gosh, this is a golden opportunity to like affect the DNA of a show. To like really put like our stamp on what this show is going to be, because who's going to tell us no? Like, it was wild. And because I knew that Steve was Steve, and as long as it was funny, you know, and still within the construct of the show that he created, he was always going to be on our side. I think that's when I really sort of like, that's when the antenna went up and was like, okay, if we do this right, we could have a hell of a ride here. Because if you recall, the premiere was like gangbusters. Like at the time it like set.
Yeah. Yeah. It was hugely successful.
And it was like the most viewed cable ship pilot of all time or something. So you combine that, like, oh my gosh, we have viewership, with the reality that the creative was going to be something that we could affect on a weekly basis. That's when I think it hit me, like, okay, we all love each other, we all trust each other, but also like we're gonna take this seriously, we're gonna do this, because I don't know how often an opportunity like this comes along. And as we can all now attest, it's not often.
No, not at all. No, it was so special. It was so special out of the gates.
Yeah, and we just wanted everybody, like we wanted everyone to sort of feel as confident in what they were doing as humanly possible, so that we could start giving episodes to people. You know, that was something that Steve and I had discussed very early on, like, okay, maybe not season one, because we really need to establish tone and, you know, people needed to sort of know what they were signing up for. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But if you go back and remember, like, Scary Sherry was the last episode of season one. And that was like a
really? Wow.
That was a Juliet episode by design. And so it was pretty early on, like in the engine, that we were like, all right, we've got good people who can do good shit, and they're funny. And if we give them good material, like, that's how we're going to grow this show. And that's how we're going to go places. So like making sure that everybody was on board and like dialed in and not checking out and not feeling complacent and not feeling like, all right, what same three lines do I say this time when I show up at the crime scene was really important to us, because that we wanted everybody like with us the whole time.
I can't wait to have you back to talk about Scary Sherry, which I do want to say, did you know right away that you wanted to, how did you approach Steve about writing in season one?
Steve approached me about writing in season
what? One. What? Oh, that's so great.
It's just like this job sort of defied everything that we've ever been taught as far as like what to expect out of this business. Like, and again, I think the common denominator is Steve Franks, because he just didn't, it's like he just didn't know any better because he's just Steve, right? And I think probably at the time, you know, his partners were probably saying, you did what? You asked Rodé if he wanted to write? What are you doing? because he was just like, well, why wouldn't I? Like, I want to do like a Halloween episode and James writes horror movies. Like, it just, why wouldn't I do that? Because he's Steve.
It's because his total lack of ego.
Yeah, he came to me like in the middle of the first season. Was like, "Hey, let's write a Halloween episode together."
Oh, and I got to benefit from that. And such, it's, I mean, it still remains one of my most favorite job experiences ever.
It was an incredible thing that he did for me and for all of us. And this was after he watched Skinwalkers, the movie that. the horror movie that had been produced before we went.
He's like, let's do
that. Recognized that it was not good.
No. So I'm gonna say the opposite side, which is Steve was very, very smart and knew exactly what he was doing, because bringing you into that position was a huge for the show. I think in shaping how it was going to go, it was very. Yeah.
It was pretty kinetic. That was my introduction to writing for television. And
that's so crazy.
Wait, was Scary Sherry?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I had written a couple movies and I'd worked with movie executives. And by the way, I had written R-rated movies. So this was not only like my first foray into television structure, like the 1 hour structure and, you know, your tags and your teasers and your act structure and all that. But I was also writing shit that we never could have put on camera. Like we never, like there was stuff in that first draft of Scary Sherry that Steve was just like, dude, what you can't behead someone. And I was like, why not?
But you can't have an axe fight.
Yeah, if you remember Scary Sherry, Bianca's toast. We called it Bianca's toast because she gets
killed. Yeah, the toaster.
But the first draft, she gets beheaded and her head bounced down a flight of stairs. That's what I wrote in the first draft. And Steve was just sort of, he was so sweet and gentle about it. But he was like, there is no world in which we can even sort of do this. And even if we were on a network where you could, you know, chop someone's head off and have it bounce down a staircase, that's not my show. So I definitely had to rein my shit in. And that was sort of probably the biggest adjustment that I had to make writing wise, was just like, oh, wait, right. I still have to fit inside of like this bubble of what we do. So I had way more of an adjustment to make as a writer than I ever did as an actor. And that's how I started learning. That's how I started learning how to write television, was because of Psych and knowing what you could and couldn't do and when to pull back and, you know, when to, it's choosing your battles, like all of the stuff that you have to sort of learn in order to be a decent television producer was just like a crash course for me, starting in the first season, which again was just unheard of. And the same thing with directing. Like I never had to go to Steve and say, I want to direct an episode. He came to me and said, I know we both want to direct. I'm going to do it first because my name is Steve Franks and I created this show and you're going to go after, and you're going to go second after me. Is that cool? And I was like, of course that's cool.
I don't know. Let me think about that.
Had Psych done the head going down the stairway, it would have bounced like a Super Bowl.
Yeah, it would have been silly. I remember him. I was like, "Boop, it's funny though. It's not like it's not scary head bouncing. It's like fun. It's silly. It's like we'll shoot it against like a wall so that it's not the head you're seeing. It's the shadow of the head, right? It'll be really cool." Doom, 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 doom,
doom. It's going to bounce if it hit Lasseter in the nose.
And then we'll shoot it from behind the head. We'll shoot it from behind the head at Sean and Gus. And so we'll just be getting like hair and their reactions. Like, get it?
Oh, my God. Well, Joms, I definitely, we're going to do a special Scary Sherry episode for sure. So that's a fun tease, but I want to have you back to talk about that for sure.
Yeah, that one's great. I mean, I know Dulé always says this too, but I couldn't agree with him more. The end of season one, beginning of season two, 1-2 punch.
American Duos, come on.
Scary Sherry and American Duos is truly what I believe kind of sent us into the direction that would really become like what we know as like our bread and butter. And because of that, I think we do owe a great deal of thanks to John Landis, because he directed both of those episodes.
Of course. And Tim Curry, right. Of course.
He brought with him, as you know, a mixed bag of skills, but he undeniably brought that special thing that he does to comedy to our show. And
no question.
And we all learned that we could do it.
Yeah.
And then I just feel like we were off and running.
Oh my God. I don't want to end this episode. This was like, I love talking about all this in the beginnings of all of our.
Spelling Bee was also a really fun episode.
Yeah.
It was just so ridiculous. And I think it's set a really nice baseline of just Mitchum.
And watching the episode again on my phone last night in bed, just so I could sort of be up on it and be professional to talk to all
You watch episodes of James in bed a lot, be honest.
Duh. A lot of it's just security camera footage from his time on what was it? It was Gardner and Sunset, wasn't it? Where you used to work?
That's right.
The streets.
That's right.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Right.
Yeah. That's a busy corner. You had people stumbling out of Il Compadre looking for a night to not be quite over.
And, is that 7-Eleven right across the street?
Yeah, that's where I got in where I fit in, Tim.
In watching the episode back, it really was one of the first times we really established the Sean and Gus relationship, that history of like what Sean had done to Gus in their childhood.
Yeah.
So it's the first time we really got to see that, I thought. Was kind of something that dawned on me.
And just how much, especially in the early going, we were going to lean into those Sean Henry flashbacks as well. Like that was...
Oh, yeah.
It was back when the formula was like set up a lesson in the flashback and then have that theme echoed in the episode. And that was a big part of the structure of the series early on, was those father-son, moments and how they manifested in their adult lives. You know, that's a big part of the Steve Franks canon, is father-son. And those early episodes were heavy. Like, I think that the Spelling Bee might have been the doghouse one, right? Where like,
yeah,
it was the doghouse. Yeah.
So yeah, that was a big part. It was a big part of the sale of the show too. Was how much Sean and Henry's relationship was going to be.
It is heavy. It's emotional. Watching it back, I remember. I was thinking about that. Just how there were some real. That's another thing about the show that I think is. Got established very early on, but those moments hit just as hard as the others. Like they really do land. Like, I think it's really hard to find that balance in comedies, to have the drama land the same way, the emotion kind of land the same way, and to have something that emotional have the comedy be as silly as we were. It all lands. And I also love too, I feel like in that episode, it aired second, but we had that first one where I am actually coaching you, I think, in Spelling Bee, Tim, on how to sort of be nice
Yeah.
For the cameras, like, yeah. Kind of the point for the cameras. Like, it's just like, at least pretend that you care.
You're right. It was really a big foundation point for Lassiter and O'Hara in their relationship. And what O'Hara does to Lassiter. What she offers him and teaches him. I'm being sensitive.
Yeah.
Being sensitive. And of course, I think my favorite of that would be the diner scene, just because that was my if I had to pick a favorite scene from that.
Yeah. I mean, that was the origin. It was Juliet's origin story.
And that's where it began.
That's where it all began.
Fifth grade
voice. That. Yeah. Yeah, it was funny. I remember the director saying, he was just like, wow. He was like, yeah, this is good. There's a, you guys have good chemistry.
Yeah, that was important.
Who directed Spelling Bee?
It was Damski.
Damski.
I forgot.
Yeah, it was the commander. It was the commander.
Mel Damski.
We're going to get we got to get the commander on as well, because I feel like, yeah.
It would mean so much to him.
Yeah absolutely. No, I was thinking about that the other day, because he really, those first couple of seasons, he kind of took over the wrangler role, while also letting it be like, James, go and do whatever you want. This was so wonderful. I can't thank you enough, Joms, just telling that whole story and how all of this kind of began, all of our, I don't know. It's so fun and so special to relive everything.
Yeah, it'll be great to hear everybody tell that story.
Yeah.
And be reminded.
Maggie, before we sign up, what you were touching on before of James sort of being the adult in the room.
Yeah.
Yeah. The success and the relationship of any cast, crew, always comes from number one in the call shooting.
Yep.
And so not only were you the adult in the room, but you so set that tone of just love and support for everyone. And I am so, I know we're all grateful for it. So thank you, Joms. I love you.
Me too, Joms.
I am eternally grateful for the opportunity, and I couldn't have asked for a better group to go on that journey with. And that's why I chose to be intimate with both of you. I only regret that it was never at the same time.
There's still time, guys. There's still time.
We both need to be in the same. We all need to be in the same town, I think.
Get on a plane.
Seriously, Tim. The fuck are you doing?
What are you doing? Get on a plane to Vancouver.
Sorry, I blame myself.
Yeah.
As you should.
Okay, good night, you guys. I love you both.
I love you both so much. And
we'll do it again.
Joms, we're having Scary Sherry for sure. And obviously, anytime we're doing anything, hop on.
I'll come back plenty. I'm super stoked for you two. I'm so glad you're doing this. I know there has been an appetite for it for quite some time. So thank you. Thank you for giving the fans more of what they want.
The psychologists are in.
Sure as
hell. Austin's idea.
Tim, stop. Come on. Come on. Anyway, we love you, everybody. Thank you. And we will talk soon. Okay.
All right. Suck it.
Spelling Bee, episode 2, in the can.
Suck it.
Bye.
That was such an incredible talk with James Lovett, or Joms, as I call him. I didn't know some of that. Did not know he almost gave up TV acting and was going back to New York. What would we have done without him? Psych wouldn't be here without him. We wouldn't be here without him. Once again, thank you all for listening to the second episode of The Psychologists Are In. Super, super special episode. We are beyond excited, to relive all of our favorite parts of Psych. Our favorite parts being all of them, as you know. Please feel free to message us on our Instagram at The Psychologists Are In, or our Twitter at PsychologistPod, because we love hearing from you. So keep the messages coming. And while you're at it, you can follow us on TikTok, where I'm hopefully getting better at this, at The Psychologists Are In. See you guys next week.